Welcome to the Classical Records Podcast, a podcast where we discuss hidden cultural circumstances of classical composers, linking the composer's life to the 21st century by zooming in on environmental, racial, gender, and mental health topics, but also wellness and nutrition, fashion, and the composer's party life. So let's dive right in. With me today is Jean-Sébastien Lévesque, the French name cousin of today's composer, Johann Sebastian Bach. Jean-Sébastien is a pianist originally from Montreal who recently moved to Vancouver, where he's engaged in the classical music scene. Welcome! Jean-Sébastien, if I'd asked you straight up about the first thought or memory that comes to mind when I say Johann Sebastian Bach, what is it?
Oh, how annoyed I was when I was young learning all these things because it never fits in the finger. We're trying to do that, and like it struggled. So I thought that people who liked Bach were just crazy psycho people or something along those lines.
So you would say that playing your Bach is pretty challenging.
Oh, it was when I was young. So it's so different than most music I used to enjoy at the time. So many lines and so many little details, and yeah.
Do you still play it from time to time sometimes these days, or is it something you stay away
do.
From?
I do, but I don't do this in front of people. Yeah, because the judgment, people judge pianists really harshly on playing Bach.
Mm-hmm. I can see that, yeah. When we talk about fear and Bach, I think we definitely can make a relation there. He was a deeply religious person, as probably any person in the 17th century. So, such deep devotion to religion that... Yeah, you'd happily work 20 hours a day just in order to please the Protestant God that, you know, you were employed by almost.
Yeah, so, you always want to please your employer.
Zooming back into the 17th century, the daily life of Johann Sebastian Bach was pretty rough. I don't know how he was able to write so many things and have 10 children while being confronted
Didn't
with the...
Didn't have, like... 20?
Yeah, probably. I think maybe 10 survived. And
oh,
he had But this is part, I just want to read out this quote here. Even middle class life in an 18th and 17th century German town was, by our standards, extremely hard. The wood stove was not yet invented. Food was cooked in a pot over an open fire. Wood had to be secured and split. Water had to be carried by hand from a cistern and woe to the family which let it freeze in the winter. A composer had to be adept at sharpening goose quills before he could write a note, and a petty prince could deny the world a deathless organ prelude by denying his ingenious lacquey a supply of score paper. So this is from Euroclassical.org, an essay by Bill Morlock, which I thought was pretty illustrative of, you know, like, it was pretty freaked up to be Bach in the 17th and 18th century. And Jean-Sébastien, you're from Quebec, so like, tell me a thing or two about cold winters, which were very prevalent in the 17th century.
We also have a lot of churches in
Quebec. Have you played like in a really cold church, and do you have like
oh, yes, because the churches are a huge building, and you know the heat goes up, so if you heat the building properly, the pressure is going to make it like really difficult to even open the door. These huge buildings are not meant to be heated, and it's actually bad for these buildings to heat them too much because it changes like it moves the wall and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually sometimes quite cold in some buildings. A weird thing is some of those that are somewhat heated, when you get to the organ place, like on the third, how do we call that?
Behind the church. The balcony?
Ball. Yeah, the second balcony where the churches are, in the Catholic churches. All the heat goes up, so when you're on the floor, it's super cold, you keep your jacket, and when you're up there, you're wearing shorts and sweating. So imagine how bad it can be for the organ.
Well, yeah, but that might, maybe Bach was wearing shorts as well, you know, who knows?
Oh, like, I don't think they were heated in that time.
Oh,
the churches, sure. How would they do that? Would probably have been impossible to heat those churches. They had to have someone pumping the organ to bring some air in the organ, so maybe they would change place and do some exercise to keep them warm. Maybe?
That's actually a beautiful picture to imagine the exercise situation in a church of the 17th and 18th century. But yeah, let's talk a little bit about the what we mentioned earlier, that instruments were, you know, like that we're afraid of playing it on the wrong instrument and whatever Bach was using during his time. And in the VSO concert, both the harpsichord and the modern fortepiano will be played.
What I've always heard is that he's seen the piano twice in his life, towards the end of his life, and the first time he disliked them, and the second time he said he liked them, but he was under pressure to say that he liked them, so nobody knows if it was meant or not.
Right, I mean, so I guess that's another mystery about Bach scholarship. What I saw that he actually, that the musical offering was, the main melody was pitched to him while he was hanging out with his son at Friedrich the Great, which was the king of the particular kingdom he was living in the east of Germany. And so Friedrich the Great, he pitched him this melody on this brand new gear, the pianoforte, and said, like, hey, I've got this cool new fancy piano. Yeah. I am going to give you this line here. And, you know, I've heard you're a pretty great composer. Your son has told me so. He is pretty good. Can you make something cool out of this? And if I understand correctly, that's how the musical offering was basically initiated. But I wonder if that fits with your story, where he maybe was kind of like, oh God, I don't want to play it on.
And the maybe it is. It's,
yeah.
I should just like read his like not his email, his letters.
Yeah.
because there's so much hearsay.
Yeah, it is. I think that definitely that's a big thing about Bach, that, you know, it's pretty long time ago, and there was not so much the fascination of biographies, I think, was not a thing yet in the 18th century.
Not
so
even
a few
the birth
things
date, yeah. is not even something people cared so much about.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, I mean, as we said originally, it's all about it was all about religion and not necessarily about the person.
Yeah.
But let's quickly listen a little bit to the three different instruments that Bach most likely has used, and I'll post the link online as well. So let's first start with the clavichord. Have you played a clavichord before?
Never.
Yeah, I had not known about that either. It was a little tiny suitcase-sized travel piano, I almost want to say. Almost like having a little keyboard at home, like a little Yamaha, where you just sit at home and you can doodle around a little bit, maybe for a small audience, but not loud at all. So let's take a listen. Any opinions about the sound of this? Would you like to have owned a clavichord?
Oh, most probably. But something important to think about is they didn't have CD players, even today people don't have CD players anymore, but they didn't have, what's this app where we get all the music?
Spotify.
So how would they listen to any music? They needed an instrument, and they either needed to play or have someone to play it for them.
Yeah.
So, most probably I would have loved to have that.
Yeah, it looks like really handy, and it's really cool. And the next one, which we'll also hear in the VSO concert, is the good old harpsichord. Have you played a harpsichord before? And could you maybe describe what the difference is in contrast to a piano?
Oh yes, you cannot do any dynamic on a harpsichord. And, all the black keys are white, all the white keys are black, and sometimes they're all different instruments, all of them. Like the pianos are very standardized, like the depth of the key when you play, the weight of each key is like really standardized. From one harpsichord to the other, they're all like unique instruments. Some of them have like a different number of notes, some of them have two keyboards, some of them have only one. Some of them have a few notes that are just like almost random, like when you get at the extremes of the piano, of the keyboard, they're like almost random notes, like they...
in between of the usual pitch that we're used to these days. Yeah,
yeah, and like you have the note for the C, but this one specific C is actually meant to play a G lower, and the B before is going to play the C, and it's so bizarre. And also the intimidating part as a pianist is if you play the harpsichord, you need to be able to tune it, and as a pianist, we just don't tune instruments. So. People who play the harpsichord, this is a totally different instrument. On the piano, we have a pedal, so it changes like the technique so much.
Mm-hmm.
When you're playing on a piano, as soon as you use a pedal, you don't need to hold the notes. And if you don't need to do it, you would tend not to do it at all, because it limits your movement a lot. On the harpsichord, you need to hold every note as long as you want them to sing.
Mm-hmm.
So that it makes it a totally, totally different technique.
Yeah.
And also the weight of the keys on the harpsichord is much lighter. The weight on the piano is much heavier.
I guess the sound is totally different since it does not have...
dynamics.
And the mechanic is very different, right? What's...
on the harpsichord you have like plucked strings, and it makes like this really click, click, click. So whenever you play a chord, it's like really infinitely obvious if all the notes are not played together. That's why they tend to arpeggiate so much more than on the piano, because... then it looks like it's actually meant not to have the chords together on the piano. Since the sound is a bit less, like, let's say, crispy.
And in the piano, it's a hammer
hitting the string. So there's so many... it changes so much the technique that you use. So it makes that most harpsichord... Like, I could play on a harpsichord and play decently, but not at a level that would compare to any harpsichord player. And the opposite is true, too. Most people who play the harpsichord can play the piano for sure, but rarely at a level at which they would play in concerts.
Mm-hmm. So let's hear a little example of the harpsichord. That was a very short example. Fascinating. So, I mean, the big difference is dynamics. That's kind of what I've heard from you when you just compared the piano and the harpsichord. Can you talk to us a little bit about dynamics? Like, is that important to you? Have you struggled with that? What are dynamics to you? A little bit about dynamics.
A very interesting question, because you have to think about that when you're playing Bach on a piano. Because would he have done any dynamic if he could have done them? Oh, most probably he would have done dynamic in a way if he could have. So it's fair to assume that. But these works were not meant to be played with dynamics. So then maybe it makes sense to play everything within the same dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe he would have done otherwise. So you end up in these non-ending questions of like, what would be the proper way to... play Bach on the piano, and no one has the answer, which is annoying, because we never stop debating and always think we're either wrong or right. And
I think that's really fascinating. And here's a little example of the pianoforte, one of the first ones. I think this is a rebuild from a possible first version in the mid 17th century, what Bach might have played. So let's take a listen. Well, I think also this is a hotly debated topic. What gear is fine to use Bach, and when does it become blasphemic towards Bach? And I think I kind of like this one quote of an article from 1986, actually, in the New York Times, and the pianist is called Rosen, and it's this interview with him, and he actually says the following: "The actual instrument one uses is nowhere near as important in Bach's music as it would be in, say, a work by Debussy. Bach didn't really care that much about sonorities. He was capable of taking one of his violin concertos and make it into a keyboard concert. then taking the same work and arranging it for an organ and chorus. In whatever guise, it remains the same piece.
The point where we gave meaning to specific instruments, and then we associate these meaning with the piece and what's going on in the piece, so then it changes everything. And I think that happened when the concert became an institution. Before that, you always had to go with the instrument that you had. And it's quite obvious when you just like look at every Bach's cantatas, like none of them have the same instrumentation. While later, when the concert became an institution and when the orchestra was a formalized thing, mostly you have like two violin section, a viola section, cello, bass, the wind section are really how many woodwind, how many brass you're going to have. And it didn't have that at Bach's time, even in Mozart's time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so interesting. Well, let's listen to some examples here, and I'll post the link as well. This is an iteration on the electric guitar. This is the E major prelude. Have you ever played the electric guitar?
Oh, never. Never. I struggle with it, playing any electric instrument, because dynamic is controlled by like a knob that you can turn, and then I'm really unsettled by that.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to another electricized interpretation of a Bach piece, which is it's called The Art of Moog, and it's an interpretation of the well-tempered Clavier by Johann Sebastian Bach. Yeah, I really like this too. It's kind of cool. It's three people standing next to each other. Four people actually standing next to each other playing a synth. Have you played the keyboard or like a synth ever, or are you staying away from that too?
Yes. Yeah. I'm really dogmatic about what I do. I play the piano and I try to stay away from anything else.
Yeah.
I would love to learn to play the organ properly with the pedals. Or they have a keyboard at the pedals, and like they have like the organist is like kind of the ancestor of the synthesizer, because like you would have these button and pull these. To have different sounds, and it's really fun.
Mm-hmm. I think Bach himself was a huge organ fan. From what I've read, is that he got himself built these very fancy organs when he was employed by one of the kings or like at one of the churches, and like was really into it. Apparently, was really good with his feet.
Who wouldn't be into like all these fun sound and like fun buttons to play with, and just like
It's cool. And the last one we're closing with is a Bach interpretation by on the saxophone, actually, which is funny, by the American Army Corps, which I find is such a funny overlap of, well, this very religious man, but I guess religion and war was connected, so...
Apparently it was something quite common when working on ships to bring a violin and play music on the ship to kill time when nothing had to be done. So, yeah.
That's something that, people do in the army too. They have to wait around.
They're on a ship and have nothing to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
But these are obviously professional musicians
Very
in
well
the
played.
Army.
Yeah, I thought that was... pretty neat, but so lots of different instruments, and I maybe anything goes with Bach, who knows. It's a funny contrast of people being really stern about Bach, at the same time there's such a breadth of interpretations.
I I remember my jazz harmony teacher, who all the time was actually every time he would show something from a jazz pianist, he would be, "Oh, but like, look, Bach does it too here."
Oh, interesting. Yes. Sometimes I'm thinking if it was like there were so many copies of those scores, maybe at one point, you know, like something was copied in the wrong way, and some of the ingenuity and like the risk taking that we assigned to Bach might have been just, you know, like an accident.
Oh, maybe.
In the copying process, but I will
maybe
never know.
Not. Like, he was into, apparently he was, he loved math and numerology and making sure that everything was like, in a way, mathematically precise, and that it made sense with everything.
Yeah.
I think he was a kind of man to do no mistake at all.
Okay, well, we'll keep up that German stereotype.
But oh, thank you so
thank you so much for joining me today, Jean-Sébastien. And I hope to see you at the next podcast. Thanks for listening in. I'm Dorothee Lesing, and have a good rest of your day.